Welcome back to the Left Field Thinking Podcast Season 4. Are you looking for a new stick for the season? Don't forget to check out our exclusive discount code from our sponsors, Dragon Hockey. There's a link in this episode's information. Their new range is out soon. Check it out on Instagram at Dragon Field Hockey. This week we've lucked out because it's possibly the best voice for a podcast we've ever had. He's an Antipodean coaching legend who has held a variety of roles in both Australia and New Zealand, where he's currently head of hockey at the Diocesan School for Girls. I was really lucky to be on an online workshop with him and begged him to come on the podcast so we could pick his brain for some coaching wisdom. So here is mine and Elliot's chat with Jason Butcher.
Don't know if you know Elliot.
How are you, mate?
You're right.
Yeah, living the dream.
We all are, aren't we? Same dream.
A dream. Maybe not the one we planned.
So to start off with, I've not got a huge amount actually for once planned. We started off with very structured interviews with the podcast. With like, we're asking these 8 questions. Actually today, I'm very blank canvas. So this is... You'll have to carry me here.
I've been nagging you to do this for ages, though, to be fair. I've been nagging you to just get off script.
Well, if you've been in our workshops, you'll know that's sort of how I like to go. So maybe that's your best plan anyway, mate.
Yeah. Well, we can start off with asking what your favourite song is again, if you want.
Well, I changed it with the second workshop, but then it wasn't good. It was interesting. The second workshop we did in this week period, it was more of a reflective, philosophical music sort of thing, whereas the first one, it was sort of old school classic type stuff that I knew.
A lot of guitar. There was a lot of guitar. Yeah.
So that is quite an interesting process to get a feel for your group. I kind of like it.
Elliot's answer would probably be something like, I don't know, Blame It on the Weatherman by Bewitched or something really cheesy pop.
What question is this? I got lost when you started talking about music. It turns me off straight away.
Well, our feeling is like when we first, so we designed this workshop and FIH, I guess, gave us the privilege of trying to see if it was something and it's taken hold pretty quickly. But one of the things we worried about was like the introductions take too much time and then you get rushed with the stuff you really want to talk about as a group, and trying to find ways to speed up that sort of get a feel for who's in the room and get them engaging, like coming out of their screen to talk and hear their own voice and so forth. So instead of what are you doing hockey? Cause that always becomes a bit of a pissing contest, you know, like I'm sure you guys will ask me, but just, and I know it gives credibility or context to who you are, but I often think it doesn't really matter. It's actually about what you believe in and, you know, your experiences and how you articulate that. So we essentially, well, this is Jamie's idea, my partner in this. He's like, well, we'll just get them to give us their name and tell us what their favourite song is. And I was like, yeah. And then we try and attach that into, I guess, the theme of this workshop, which is, it's called Game Day Coaching, but, you know, it's really more about having a holistic approach to how you influence your team during the game. And we try and connect that to, you know, music, harmony, rhythm, all those sort of things. Probably haven't fully got that infused, but that was part of that starting point,
no,
I suppose.
Makes sense. Now I'm trying to think of my favourite song, but I don't think I've got one. Probably quite older than myself. Beatles. Eric Clapton, something like that, maybe.
I went Rolling Stones.
Yeah, which, nice.
Give Me Shelter, Rolling Stones.
They did a good thing the other night on one I was on, and it was Sheep. Different sheep, 9 different pictures of sheep doing different things, and they had a number on each picture and you had to say what number you were at, and like some of them were obviously like smiley, happy, some of them were sad, some of them were like hiding. That was quite a decent talking point.
Right, cool. Yeah.
You are right, it is a bit of a pissing contest. I have this thing where and Elliot nibbled on this because I put this on Twitter the other week. I don't understand why people put what level coach they are in their Twitter bio. Because it just doesn't really matter. And it says a lot about them, I think. Immediately, Elliot changed his level 3 FIH coach.
It is interesting. And like the whole, I think we're on the right track now with education being more around like sharing experience and knowledge versus ticking boxes. But, you know, most of the jobs I sort of, I guess, got accelerated into or whatever, I didn't have any accreditation. I didn't really believe in it. So then you get a thing where, you know, you're with the Hockey Roos or whoever, and the high performance manager's going, you really need some accreditation, Butch. And then you go through this RPL process, and all of a sudden you've got accreditation and you haven't done any real courses. But I'm not a big fan either. But I think now we're having maybe a better approach to it, where we're just sharing stuff and building knowledge in the community that way.
Yeah. And what's been your, like, if you had to say that was a great learning experience, or has it been more hands-on learning on the job, or is there something that maybe has gone that was really useful?
Well, I've always been quite curious. I read a lot, and I read a lot of diverse stuff that I try and bring back into, you know, thinking of different ways to explain stuff and different ways of doing things, I suppose. So there's a bit of that. But I was quite lucky when I started, because I started in the Northern Territory, which, if you know, in Australia, this is an old stat, but basically they have 0.02% of the hockey population in Australia. This is a couple of decades ago. But so you've got like six club teams competing on a national stage with massive places like Western Australia and so forth. So just not getting flogged is a pretty good outcome generally. But it gave me an opportunity to be quite bold and experimental with stuff that we did to find a solution to compete. And, you know, from that you're building all these diverse experiences and then knowledge, because you start to see how everything pieces together. So that's always been a big part of my development as a coach, I suppose, like just trying new things. But, you know, even my schooling education background, I didn't really fit into any of that. So I would say I'm probably self-taught with most things, which sort of works for me, because I like to grab hold of what I'm interested in, not told you've got to understand this.
One of the interesting things, when you're as a coach and someone's telling you that you haven't ticked a load of boxes, that can set a real bad mindset in terms of then how you might approach courses. And I think you see that quite a lot in coach education, that people feel, oh, right, I have to do this to get to that post or whatever. And therefore, their whole approach to this sort of linear coach development journey can be really...
Well, we do that, you know, as a system, you know, like the people that win things generally are the ones that get elevated through the system, you know, and all those things, as we talk about on that other course, it's like those things create certain behaviours, because they're the outcomes you need to keep your job or, you know, to progress. And so it takes us away maybe from what's important, you know, and from a course accreditation perspective, it should be about the learning. But really what we're trying to do is to quickly tick it off. We're competent so we can get to the next one, so that we can apply for jobs and say, oh, I'm an FIH coach or whatever it is. Because we value winning and tickets, unfortunately, we're essentially training people to function that way, I think.
I realise we haven't done this yet. Would you like to give a brief intro as to who you are, what you do, what you've done, and what's led you to this point?
Yeah, this is my least favourite question of doing these things, but...
This is the pissing contest bit, isn't it?
Yeah, minimal pissing, come on.
Well, I won't give you any of that, but it's a really eclectic journey, which I think comes out in, you know, some of the things I believe in and talk about. But I started as a development officer type role, participation, grassroots stuff. I've been Institute of Sport head coach in a number of different places, been a high performance manager, a technical director. So we're talking Western Australian Hockey, Auckland Hockey. I've been a national coach in various roles, including as an assistant coach of the Hockey Roos, various roles of the Black Sticks. Been a consultant for Hockey Australia with our National Indigenous Talent Identification Program, which is pretty cool. Been a commentator, hockey, other sports. So that's like a 25-year period of all that jumping around. I've also coached in the Australian Hockey League and the New Zealand National League, I think maybe 13 times, and obviously lots of other junior age stuff. And at the moment I'm back in New Zealand and I'm working at a school as their director of hockey, fantastic school, Dyson School for Girls. So that's a new experience, trying to have an impact in a different space, which has been quite a cool journey. And I'm privileged and lucky enough to be doing a fair bit of stuff with the FIH with their, in their education space, especially in this strange moment of time where people are sort of locked up and, you know, online global learning is a thing to, you know, for all of us to maybe catch up and at least have purpose or do something, I suppose. Yeah, and I'm a country boy. Maybe that'll give you context as well. I was born and raised in a dairy farm in the southwest of Australia. Had three younger brothers and an old man who was a bit of a legend in that area, coach, community leader. And, you know, we just followed him around. So I never really realised it, but I was probably raised to be a coach or do these things because that's sort of what our upbringing was.
You said you're currently in a school. Had you worked in an educational environment before this role?
No. And it sort of pans out. It's all pretty much the same thing, just with different, you know, policies and rules and regulations about how you make things happen, I suppose. But no, and I think if any of my teachers from high school, the various high schools I got put in and out of, if you like, they'd be shocked that I'm working at a school.
Is that a sort of poacher turned gamekeeper change transition for you?
I've never heard that, but yeah, that's reasonably apt. Yep.
I mean, me and Elliot, well, Elliot's still in a school. I worked in a school for 5.5 years, and I found that transition to be really interesting, mainly because, I mean, it was a deliberate decision because I felt like I wanted a more substantial role just to focus on. But I also was kind of aware that when you're coaching, normally you're on your own. And I felt like that wasn't the healthiest way of, you know, working, and felt like I wanted to have colleagues. But then that transition to them being part of a group of 100 staff in terms of teaching staff, let alone all the support staff that were around it, I found really difficult because your autonomy is completely stripped away.
To a degree. I mean, there's always ways to influence and change those things. I always think that most jobs in sport, like there is a job description, but your character and what you believe in and what your strengths or your focuses are, that job description always sort of shifts and evolves around who the person is to a degree. It's obviously got to still fit, but I think there's lots of different jobs around the world where, you know, any given person would do it differently, even though the job description is the same.
I think it's quite a good stomping ground as well in terms of trying to find what you're about and what you want to implement. And because you've got sort of a repetitive season with kids that are coming up and through, you can start to see that talent development develop and team development bits develop, and you get that idea of what worked, what didn't work in quite an accelerated space of time almost.
Yeah, it's such a great age cohort. And I think for me, like, you know, you work with high performance athletes, senior or junior, and you're often trying to almost reprogram stuff to a degree. It's a more malleable place to make a difference to get some of the basics right, I think. So that interests me, that sort of process to see what that looks like. But I think also, like, I've got three kids, and I just feel like our youth and sport, like we're sort of walking towards a cliff. You know, you've got social media, technology, all the addiction and, you know, people not being active, diet. Like there's all these pieces which I don't think we're doing a very good job of. We're sort of like just closing our eyes and hoping it goes away. And I think sport is a key part of that solution, you know, like, everyone doing a really good job with that, and that sort of holding kids' focus and keeping them in places where their lives are going to be a bit more balanced and enriched instead of getting sucked into these little screens their whole life, you know. So that was part of the attraction for me as well, trying to see what that looked like and try and make a difference from a sport perspective in an age which is really important for what these kids, you know, will become, what sort of adults will they be and what will their lives look like.
It's an incredibly privileged position, actually, working in education. And you are probably as influential as you can be as a coach in terms of the impact that you can have on people's lives. As you say, developing those behaviours and habits that will last them for a lifetime, hopefully.
it's a massive responsibility and privilege. I think I agree, because you know these kids, the parents, they look to you. You know, so everything you do has to be very thoughtful and deliberate, I think. And certainly for me, the responsibility, I wouldn't say it weighs me down, but I'm really conscious of it. Like, I'm not flippant about, oh, we're just doing hockey in a school. Like, it's much, much bigger than that.
The bit I found with it, or at least there's a couple of, one of the parents here is a teacher, so he's a colleague of mine, and I coach his son and his daughter, and he just sent me an email out of the blue a year ago, maybe 2 years, and just said, oh, just so you know, at dinner last night, they wouldn't shut up about hockey. And I had absolutely no, you know, I thought, oh yeah, she's a good goalie. He plays a bit outfield, but you never realize quite how much of an impact you can have or yeah. expect it to come in that sort of form.
100%. And both ways, you know, we see a lot of it going wrong because there's a lack of understanding or a lack of awareness of certain behaviors. The stakes are high, I think.
I thought when you were saying both ways, then I thought me and Elliot never stopped talking about hockey, which is a very accurate assessment. But so, when you look back at those different roles that you've had, you know, performance director, technical director, development officer, teacher, what are common in terms of how you operate in those roles, or have you changed significantly?
I've definitely changed significantly as a person, and I hope it's growth, but, you know, early days I had, like, the development officer job was the first thing, but that allowed me to coach representative teams, and I hadn't really done much of either of that. And so I coached the Northern Territory under 18 boys, and we won the national championship. I think it was about 2003, which was massive at the time, you know, back page, front page. And we had kids like Desmond Abbott, if you remember him. So it was, you know, I probably didn't do much except stay out of their way, but there's a serious cohort of boys that just happened to be in this small place, amazing kids. And so even though I was doing different jobs, you know, even the Institute of Sport head coach job, which I quickly got elevated to in the Northern Territory, it was sort of a means to an end to coach for me. And I became really unhealthily ambitious and obsessive about, you know, just not sleeping, working, and, you know, it took me a long time to work through what that lack of looking after myself did to my behaviours, and also, you know, the word ambition, what that does to your behaviours as well. And maybe it's one of those things that you can explain and talk to people about, but until you grow older and you've got lots of scars, it's maybe really hard to build, I won't say wisdom because that's a bit silly, but yeah, trying to build your own wisdom to get better understanding of things and to do a more sophisticated, deliberate job in all the things that you do in sport. So my early coaching was, you know, it was fire and brimstone, rocky speeches, a lot of motivation and just emotion, you know, and it worked. And I won lots of things, or had a successful period where I kept sort of getting fast-tracked through different things. And, you know, there was a point where I sort of crashed health-wise, personal life-wise, and, you know, even in the jobs I was doing, because I sort of just lost my way because of that ambition and that obsessiveness. So, you know, me now, I work very hard to try and understand, I guess, the more holistic nature of those relationships and those leadership responsibilities and how they affect everything. You know, so I've gone from fire and brimstone to hopefully walking a path towards being a bit more of a Zen warrior and being really deliberate and deliberate and experienced and thoughtful about every little tiny little thing that I do, because I'm starting to understand that everything has an impact on people and so forth.
So if you look back now in terms of maybe pre-Zen Butch.
I like that, yeah.
Are there any key moments when you look back in terms of how you were behaving then that you go, oh, shit, that was crap? Like, and if you were in the same position now, you would operate differently, or is it just a transition that you're comfortable with?
I don't have regrets, but I often... different things pop in my mind in still moments. So I I reflect on all of them. There would be a, you know, a chapter or a book on the little mistakes, the big mistakes, the, you know, the cringe moments going, oh, that was actually me. That's my story, you know. But, you know, it doesn't bury me because I understand it's part of the journey. I think as a species, we're pretty flawed, you know, and really the only, the main responsibility and solution is just to be honest enough to reflect and grow and to continue to get better. I think if we unpacked anybody's career, whether it's in sport or whatever, that's the path, you know. You make mistakes, you hope they're not terminal, and you figure out how to understand them and grow as quickly as you can so that you're a better person, and especially in our space, you're a better leader, because you know that there's a lot at stake with what people are looking to from you that's affecting and influencing their lives and who they are.
When I look back, this is about you really, but I'm going to talk about me. When I look back, there's one.
That'll be a recurring theme.
Yeah.
End of the podcast.
There was actually one moment. It's funny when you say as long as these moments aren't terminal. I think the when it goes wrong with personal relationships with players, that can be very hard to rectify. I remember one instance of me calling a lad out when I was coaching a university team. He was probably going through a bit of a crap time, to be honest. And he was on the baseline, hit a reverse stick shot, and it hits the goalie at the near post and goes in. And he's celebrating. I'm just like, why are we shooting there? Like, and I laid into him in front of the group because I thought, it's the start of the season. Let's, you know, get the right behaviours and just completely destroyed a quite a good relationship with a player, and it never recovered.
Can't take some things back like that, can you?
Yeah,
I've always felt like I've been pretty good with that because for whatever reason, it's probably my father, I've always just cared about and, you know, in that context sort of fallen in love with players and teams. And so I think I've generally been pretty careful with that. It's obviously gotten a lot better over the decades, but my issue has always been with, you know, management and, you know, it's the, I guess, the authorities of the team and the sport and not managing that well from, you know, not looking after myself and being immature and naive and all those sort of things. But, you know, the player space for me and those relationships as initially naturally and then hopefully with more experience been a strength is a sort of what I guess if you unpack what it's all about for me, that's what it's all about, trying to help people and help them become better at what they're trying to do, achieve their goals and ultimately become better people with you as a small part of trying to influence and support them with that, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. There's one phrase that really irks me that certain people use is, don't get too close to the players. And I'm not convinced that's the best advice. There are obviously like professional boundaries and stuff like that, but you're talking about those relationships and that being a key driver and a key sort of strength of your coaching. What would the boundaries be around those relationships? What is the desired outcome of those relationships? And what's the process you would go along in terms of trying to strengthen the relationship between a coach and athlete?
Well, I think I probably can't articulate that boundary. It's probably something I need to spend more time on because it's an important thing. But I agree. Like, I worry about that statement because, you know, one of my sort of coaching philosophy values is care. And if you can't build a relationship where athletes or even staff feel like you understand their whole life picture and how that connects to what they're trying to do here and what we're trying to do here means to them, if you don't have all that context and detailed understanding of that and they don't see that you want to understand those things, it's really hard to do the best you can for them, I think. And it could be a style thing, you know, but that's maybe just the person that I am. But I think they need to know that you've got them and that they, you know, you're keeping on making sure they understand they belong to this and that it's something important. But probably in terms of the boundaries, I think it's mainly about language. You know, I see a lot of, you know, junior coaches or administrators in sport make mistakes when they say things which are worded poorly that are almost promises to get rid of a short-term problem and thinking, oh, we'll deal with that later. And they make massive problems because people hold those promises and then go, well, you said I was going to be in the second 11 team next year. And it's like, you can't say things like that. So I think the biggest boundary consideration for me is around I'm coach and yes, I have to make decisions, but I care about you, is you just got to be really careful with language and what you say to people so you don't set them up or set yourself up for that to fracture at the next, whatever, whenever that juncture is where a decision has to be made and it might not go their way.
The nuance of how we talk as well, you know, the sort of words we use, we and I statements, and particularly with kids, they remember things and they hang on every word. And if you don't get the nuance of how you're talking absolutely bang on, they can infer so much stuff that they, as they like, cling on to, and you might not really recognize that.
Well, we don't like uncertainty. And so, you know, that's where a lot of it comes from. People want guarantees. And it's one of the early boundaries is that there aren't any guarantees. And then you have to be really good, as you say, with your language around everything you say, whether it's to the group or to individuals, in a way where it's a bit like Rick's thing of being, you know, the comfortable uncomfortable and the uncomfortable comfortable. It's the balance between that so that they don't feel like everything's uncertain and it's doing their head in, but at the same time that the only guarantee is that if they work as hard as they can and buy into what we're doing, they give themselves the best chance.
I really enjoyed the game day coaching workshop, actually. I thought it was really good. It was a bit like, the flavour of it was very different. I think having two, you know, having an Aussie and a New Zealander run it naturally gave it a very different flavour.
It's like a bar joke, right? The Aussie and the New Zealander walking in the bar.
Yeah. I don't know who the butt of that joke would be, though. That's difficult.
Well, probably me.
Yeah, I thought it was really good. It was a bit like, it was almost being like on a radio show as well. It was very relaxed and just really engaging. And I thought, actually, I thoroughly recommend anyone listening to log on and do that one, sign up for that one, because it's really good. After the personal challenge that you gave around people's statements, it's one of my biases to be like uncomfortable like that. So that was great that you put me on the spot a few times. But I thought it was excellent. But you talked a lot in that around our influence and what we influence on the game day and how we are, you've kind of touched on it, I suppose, how we are deliberate in that influence. I wonder if you could just expand or talk around that a little bit.
Yeah. You want me to condense the three-hour workshop where we piece all that together? Well, I think, and this might make it harder for people to understand, but the thing we stumbled across was that quote around music is the space between the notes. And we sort of go through a story around what we think coaching is and the things that we focus on getting really good at, and that maybe there's all these spaces that we're not aware of or attending much enough of our attention to get good at. And then that ties that into this often common belief that coaching is, we're professional communicators, like coaching is about communicating, but understanding that, you know, there's a couple of pieces of communication. The first one is that it's really about how it's received and how it's interpreted, not how well you spoke or did a diagram. So there's that piece. But then the other piece is that even if they interpret it right and understand it and you're on the same page, it still doesn't mean anything unless it turns into action. And so the big theme, I guess, that runs through the workshop is that really your job is to influence. And then, you know, as you know, we talk about what are the things you need to be in control of and understanding of so that you influence the right things, and also you're not influencing things in ways that you're not in control of or aware of that are negative because you don't understand all the different little subtle bits and pieces which are impacting everybody every second, every moment of that experience that we're all under pressure in during the game. I don't know, mate. Did that give you a bit of a wrap?
It's just enough of a taster, really, isn't it, to get people into it? In terms of the virtual coach education, how much suppose you've done the technical and the performance director roles and stuff like that before. Yeah. How has that experience lent itself to educating coaches remotely?
Initially, it's quite a bizarre thing. I did a level one FIH course online, and yeah, I didn't really know what I was doing. I mean, the stuff we were talking about, I'm, you know, competent with and understand and so forth. But I just took an approach, which I sort of use with my coaching, where I just started telling stories, and often obscure stories, to get people thinking about what they're doing and what it all means. So I generally get paired up with someone who's a bit more like keep on the path, butch, come back in here. So maybe I'm the maverick with the, you know, we're getting these partnerships right about how we do these courses. But
I think that's where we've gone wrong, Will.
You got two mavericks.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's Jamie's role in that workshop that we do. But I just think, one, the power of stories to get people thinking is something that resonates with people on those courses. And because of this diverse sort of crazy journey I've been on, and the opportunity where I'm quite curious and I experiment all the time, there's a lot of content there to open people's eyes and to get them thinking about what they're doing. And a lot of these stories as well that I tell sort of ask the question, and this is something I'm really big on, are the things that we think are important and that we sort of fixate on doing really well, like our regimented dynamic warm-ups, for example, for half an hour before we play, are they actually as important as we think they are? And so that's sort of a thread that I take in this education space as well. It's not just like, here's all the science, do this. It's here's some stories to make sure that you're challenging everything and you're not just swallowing stuff and regurgitating what we've always done. You know, I want people to think, and I want people to challenge stuff, and I want them to explore maybe that there's better ways of doing everything, because I think there is. So I probably went off on a tangent, didn't answer your question there, mate, but you probably get used to that. But that's sort of my approach and what I think I bring to that space at the moment, which I think is a nice balance, and it seems to be working pretty well.
Yeah, I'd agree. I think me and Elliot have spoken quite a lot with each other around coach development. The key skill for me that coaches have to have is to be a reflective practitioner. And I think the way that you use storytelling to sort of foster that within a course setting was really good in terms of, and then just the challenge. When you ask a question, how do you know how far to push the person in terms of their answer? How do you judge that? You've spoken about personal relationships and connections and stuff like that. How do you know in a coach education setting how deep you need to cut to get the appropriate outcome?
Yeah, it's a tricky one, right? Because you get repeat people you start to build a relationship with because they're on different courses, but you're generally speed dating your relationship to then have a base where you can work together and have a conversation and get each other thinking and trying to, you know, for me, it's not instructional or it's not a debate. It's putting things up and trying to figure it out together. So my approach is very much there's not a right way. And we say it at the start of that workshop, it's like, we're not here to tell you what to do. We want to open your eyes and get you to think more deliberately about this and maybe come from a different angle. So the odd, you know, the odd debate or the point that maybe is off center from what I think. I think if there's some merit to it or it makes sense, I don't really try and like pin people down and go, nah, that's nonsense. I try and just give information and work with them on maybe why and how they can think of it a bit differently when they go away, to use what they believe in, but not get locked in on it and maybe add some thought to how that looks. So for whatever reason, I think we've got a good balance with that, where there isn't a lot of that. Like, you get the people, the academics who challenge stuff in those workshops, and I sort of enjoy it because it's not about being right. It's about, okay, this is cool. Let's all talk about this and see what we think. And often all of us add another layer to our knowledge because somebody's chucked that contrarian thought in, or, you know, want to be a bit of an antagonizer. But I think if you manage it as in, I, we can all learn from this and maybe think about things differently or go away from it differently, I think it's a positive. So it doesn't really get stressful from that perspective.
I think a lot of it comes down to how coaches view themselves as well, in the sense of, do they have that intuition about what's stressing them out? I know for ages, like you said, about sort of the motivator and being that sort of person. But then the flip side of that is you get pissed off on the sideline, or you can get really angry, you can blow really hot and cold. And it's actually understanding your emotions quite a lot as to your reaction, and then how that then can portray the conversation you have, or have you checked yourself before you've had that conversation, all those little pieces.
Yeah. And, you know, there's getting that feedback, being aware of those things that you do, and there's a real honesty with yourself that's attached to that. But I think the other thing that we sort of try and bring out, especially around coaching during the game and emotion, is that, you know, if you understand the biology, and I'm no expert, you really aren't in control when you allow yourself to get taken to those places. And the other part of that is that you can hack your biology in a way where if you prepare properly, sleep, diet, maybe meditation, whatever you do to be in that space in a really good, with a good mindset, and then even during the game, it's a part of the art of coaching which maybe we don't put enough focus on. You know, me being in an optimal space so that I can be in control and do my very best job for the team in that pressure space.
So how do you do, like, if you had to put that into tournament context, having been to a few myself, I find very much I end up, you spend up a lot of the time on your laptop, analysing, etc. How do you go about managing that during those super high stress situations?
You've got to have good staff and you've got to delegate, but also I would question, you know, because I've done that forever, you've got to know what's important. So there's an experience and a, I guess, understanding of your own beliefs around your team and how hockey works. But the balance of trying to leave no stone unturned and not sleeping, I would argue that know what you're prioritizing on, do it quickly and efficiently, and get to sleep. It's not actually going to do anything trying to watch that video for another 2 hours. There's nothing there that you're going to be able to influence that you haven't seen if you've been targeted and efficient with your sort of review, reflection stuff straight afterwards. I just think we get stuck in looking for one percenters and we forget that we're actually a much bigger part of that puzzle that needs to be looked after versus getting that 1%. So it's a trade-off. And my trade-off is that I need to be happy and healthy and ready to go versus trying to find one obscure thing or make sure that I'm right about what we're going to do tomorrow.
You spoke about care for your athlete. You've got a duty of care to your staff as well. And if you're a head coach, they will look at, if you're the person staying up till 3 a.m. on your video, there's an implied pressure there and an expectation, or an inferred pressure and expectation that they should be doing the same. And I think you have a real duty to role model what actually is the expectation. And I think coaches get obsessed with, I'm a bit anti-video because I think my experiences are, I'm not convinced there's a huge payoff, bang for buck, certainly in a tournament when you're up
till, you're obviously wrong.
Yeah.
Just up till, so we can put that out there.
Yeah. But up till 3 a.m, which, you know, you've done at junior international tournaments, doing this video and you're knackered the next day and you can't have the same interaction with players. You can't notice things in the game because you're just dead.
And I just, 100%.
Yeah, I just think you've got to role model that with the group and just not get anxious about
there's a flip side to it though, isn't there, in the sense of I can't remember who I was talking to about it, but, you know, going for a run, getting out, doing something that you would normally do when you're at home. So particularly in lockdown, it shows you that, doesn't it? But actually, if you're at a major tournament, yes, you have your hour or two to code or whatever, and then you go out and you have a run, because actually you need to, or in the morning before a game you do that to, again, it's about biology, I guess, like you said.
Yeah, you got to prioritize, you know, like, and it's a bit like what we talk about in this game day workshop, is that it's what you do around the game that matters in terms of how you then, what you have to do during the game. And it's no different for a tournament, you know. If you come into a tournament and the team knows how they're trying to play, they know what's coming, they're coming up against, they know the different challenges around rest recovery, the whole thing around how it's going to work, then you can be a lot more streamlined and efficient about what you actually spend your time on, and you can value and look after the recovery aspect, you know, the chance to be still and just have a mental recalibration, you know, looking after your, like the social stuff with your players and then with each other. So it's still, you know, there's joy, downtime, fun. There's lots of things that maybe get swept aside when we're obsessively trying to find things that really probably aren't even there anyway. And how much impact will they have if we know, you know, that fullback rolls in and they do this. If you teach your teams well, they're looking for those things, and hopefully you see it in the game and you can adapt and solve it anyway, instead of spending 6 hours less sleeping. And your point about the modelling, I think, is really important, because, you know, if your coach is tired and grumpy and, you know, not unshaven and bedraggled, like, that has to have an impact on the mindset of your players or have an effect culturally. Whereas if you're valuing and explaining to them, you're really clear and crisp about what you're doing and you're valuing time off, social cohesion, diet, sleep, all these things, then that becomes the culture of your team. And it's got to have an impact on the mindset that they go into games with, especially when they're under pressure.
You've spoken about your dad as being someone who was an influence and probably showed you the path. If you look around at the other coaches and people that you've worked with and have been around, who would be sort of key influences on your development, and what would be the things that you've taken from them?
Yeah, there's probably a list of that I've learned from about what I don't want to do or be, but I won't go through them. Yeah, it's a tough one. There's lots of little bits and pieces. I don't have like someone I look up to. Like, I have people that I study, like a Jose Mourinho, but not because I want to be him. I want to understand, you know, this short-term success. How does he get it? Why does he lose the dressing room? So there's things like that. I really like watching Klopp at the moment and how he carries himself. There's a lot of things, without being in the four walls, that I think resonate with what I believe in. So I enjoy watching him and reading as much as I can about what he's actually doing and how he's doing it. There probably wouldn't be a one. I've had lots of great mentors and I've had access to great people. You know, I had an office next door to Rick when I was in the women's program, his men's program, Barry Dancer when I was the Institute coach. So there's all Mark Hager, had lots of support and mentorship from him. So I've been very fortunate to have access to some amazing coaches and leaders. And I think I've just sort of taken what I think their strengths are and what I believe in and tried to figure out whether that's something that I can add to or improve in myself.
Looking at today's game one, Spain versus Belgium.
Yeah.
And seeing where those two teams are, looking ahead to Tokyo, what do you expect to see?
Sounds like a gambler's question. I think the biggest thing
there's a follow-up call, so don't be wrong, because we'll call you and say you were wrong.
Well, I'm very well versed on the whole indefinite pronouns thing, so I'll make sure that none of that can stick to me the way I articulate this.
Elliot doesn't understand what you've just said there. That's too
hilarious. Well, I probably don't either, but, you know, sometimes words come out of my mouth and you look them up later and you go, oh, yeah, that made sense. I don't know how it got in, but so I think there's a lot of unknowns. We don't even know whether the Olympics are going to go ahead or what certain countries and teams are going to be able to do in terms of their preparation. You get a feel through your network and relationships of what everyone's done over the last 12 months, and that gives you some information around who's scrambling and who's well-positioned, which I won't share here. So there's an element of that. But I think the great thing about this Olympics for hockey, if it goes ahead, is that we might get a left field winner or left field medals. And I think there's going to be...
That was very on message, by the way, for the podcast. So thank you for that.
I know, mate. I do my homework, of course.
Good.
Not a problem. And I think there'll be some great stories, hopefully, that come out of that about how did you, against the constraints of this pandemic and this 2 years, what were the innovations around your approach that helped you win these medals in the in these most unique Olympic games. So I'm kind of looking forward to that, because that's the stuff that I love. I want to see the coaches and the programs who are brave and bold and innovative around trying to get a leg up, and or even just trying to figure out how they prepare properly. So that's quite exciting for me to see, because I think then we'll find out who the great coaches really are in our current sort of international cohort, you know.
There's an article come out today. I just read it from, I don't know who read it. It was about the Seattle Seahawks in this past season. And of 700 COVID cases in the NFL, they're the only team not to get any positive tests throughout the whole season. And that's come down to that there's been some teams that have lost all three of their quarterbacks. There's been some teams that have played without any receivers, and they've managed to avoid getting one case. And it was all by design and massively purposeful. And like you said, yeah, it'd be interesting to see how that has affected coaches' planning.
Yeah, because it's not just how do we prepare, because we can't travel and play anyone and we don't have anyone. It's those things. It's also leading in the future. What are the things that might pop up that which can basically derail our program out of our control? Like, you know, your four defenders getting COVID. I don't know. Or you've only got one international level goalkeeper. How do you make sure they don't get sick or whatever? So trying to think of all the what ifs and having contingencies around your design, you might get lucky, but I suspect you're right. I think the teams that do well will be ahead of the game with making sure those things don't go out of their control and derail their Olympics.
I think as well, there's an element in there, you know, you've said about care of athletes, like you've got to prioritise the people's safety and wellbeing, haven't you? You know, yeah. What are the basic minimums of coaching? Well, it's looking after the people that you're responsible for. We've had situations this year where at the club in Belgium where, oh, you know, should that person have to do 10 days of quarantine? You're like, yes, we're not. Even if it doesn't matter if they get caught or not, it doesn't matter. What's the important thing is we don't create any risk to anyone else at the club. Or any other, who cares if it means we haven't got our best player available for a match? What's the right thing to do for the group? And I think you've just got to really balance the relative importance of things, and you know, people are more important, aren't they?
Always, but it's also complex, because keeping them safe at a, like if you go to the nth degree to make sure no one in your group gets COVID or gets exposed, then you could be sabotaging or are diluting their chance of doing well at the Olympics. So it's not as simple as we're going to make sure our people are safe and well, because for some of these guys, healthy or unhealthy, this is their life moment right now. And, you know, if you don't get the balance right to give them a chance at performing at the Olympics because you're only focused on keeping them healthy, yeah, that is a complicated thing to get your head around, I think.
That's a real creativity, isn't it? That's where you're going to see the innovation. And I think the haves and have-nots of programs, like the GB program is incredibly well-funded and doesn't have to rely on club hockey. They don't really care about club hockey, the GB staff. So actually, have they been that impacted? They've been training full-time. They've lost their club games, but, you know, whereas you look at other countries that have been, you know, the Dutch have had quite a lot of restrictions.
But maybe also if you have, like in New Zealand, we've been pretty much playing hockey for a year. Like there was disruptions, but we got a season of hockey out. You know, other countries have been in lots of more bigger lockdowns, hard to do the normal things you would do even from a normal hockey community perspective. But maybe different countries will be forced to rethink how they do it. And maybe we don't know everything and some will stumble upon a better way just because they've been forced to solve it or be creative, as you say. So I think there'd potentially be some great stories about that, which we can all learn from. And I think with a lot of things we just regurgitate from the past and we get fixated on this is the best way to do things. And often we hold the course with that, because if we do something brave and left field and it fails, there's this sort of, you know, stigma attached to it. Whereas if we all just sort of do what each other's doing and we fail or we go okay, I might still keep my job and I'm not going to be, you know, pushed out of the pale because I'm, you know, I'm clueless or just don't know what I'm doing. So we follow the herd a lot just to be safe. The problem is if you follow the herd, the best teams will win and you can't sort of change or reframe the battle. Bit of the David and Goliath stuff. So maybe the battle's going to be reframed by virtue of the constraints that different countries have, and we're going to see some crazy things pop up around how they got to the Olympics and what they've learnt and what it means to their performance.
We've got I've taken over the Welsh under 18 girls, and we're trying to, I took over in January, and that was all delayed because of COVID, and we were meant to have our selection assessment day on the 2nd of January, and we're moving towards the under 19 Euros this summer. And already the parameters just keep changing and changing and changing. Like, you know, we're going to have selection in February. February's gone. We're going to hopefully have it in March. Well, we don't know what's going to happen. And it's been so much fun as a group of staff just to try and work out how are we moving forward? What does it look like if we have to select a squad of, you know, get a 54 group squad down to 24, and then we get the under 19s come in and we only get a month to train them. You know, we might go to Scotland with having, I've not seen the girls yet. I've known them online for 2 months. I've not seen them pick up a stick. So the amount of challenges, like you say, so, you know, we got a camp this weekend. We're diving into selection because it's a cool topic that we can talk about online, and we're trying to reframe it and make it a bit more, I spoke with Sophia Jarrett about trying to change the mindset on deselection a little bit and trying to have that conversation early with them. And it's been really great to just try and, like you say, it's been totally turned on its head. And some of the stuff that's come out of it's been brilliant already.
Yeah, and that's the, like, this disruption isn't all negative. There are opportunities, and I think we'll stumble across better ways of doing lots of things because we've been forced to find these solutions. You know, clearly, even as a basic example, like the online platforms like Zoom, and you can even do cool stuff with like platforms like Huddle. You know, instead of having an hour meeting or all these meetings with your team, it's like, at 7 o'clock, everyone's home and sorted after tea, and you spend 20 minutes on that platform and you take away that stress footprint of having to be at hockey longer, be in a sterile room, no one listening. You put it in back in the comfort of their lives, in their timeline, in their homes. You know, maybe there's something there around how we spend our time communicating with each other where we can do it in a better way. So I think there's lots of stuff that's coming out because we're forced to, as you say, find all these new creative solutions to these problems that where I'm stuck with.
We've just had a voluntary chat on a Thursday night for the whole squad just to go, look, just come along if you want to have a chat. And sometimes we talk about hockey, sometimes we don't even mention it. And already those conversations have been so powerful at shaping lots of different things and talking about movies. Like you say, your favourite song was asked last week. So I should have been more prepared for that one. But also we sort of reframed it to the girls saying, like, you know, we've got in our pool, we've got Czech Republic, France and Italy. Well, how are they dealing with COVID? Can we get ahead of them? What do you go, you know? And it's really cool. It's just been, as you say, we've actually been so positive with it already. And some of the stuff the under 16 girls are doing is just brilliant with Mike. They've been doing their IDPs already and their holistic development plans. So it's nothing to do with the stick and ball stuff, which is massively powerful.
I mean, you talk about positives, like one big thing for me is how much more connected the global hockey community is. Like all of these FIH courses, done on remote learning, is, you know, it's not the same as being in the room with people, but you're online with so many people you'd never be in a room with at all.
And there's more conversations because you're right, like the face-to-face stuff, and there's obviously other benefits from that around relationships, but I was quite surprised around the strength of relationships you can build through the online connections, I suppose. Like all the courses I've done, there's always three or four people because I say, look, if you've got any questions or something crazy you're up to, like just buzz me, I'll get back to you. And you're meeting all these amazing people, which is clearly strengthening our global coaching hockey network because everyone's like building it and meeting new people. But also, like I selfishly say, and a lot of the courses I have the privilege of leading, like for me, I'm just the knowledge and my perception or perspective on different things is like adding a layer every time I talk to these different diverse groups of people, because there's things they've experienced or have knowledge of that I don't. And it just keeps adding to my own views and story. And I suspect that's happening to everyone. So I'm quite buoyant around what hockey will look like when the pandemic goes away, because there's going to be hundreds of coaches thinking differently around how they're going to approach their coaching. So I think it's going to be a great time for coaching once we get up back and running properly, you know.
Yeah, definitely. And I think people as well have a network that they can tap into now. So where yeah. I've got this idea, right, I'm just going to talk it through with you over Zoom. What do you think? How would you deal with it? Because people are connected with people who aren't rivals. Like, yeah. Yeah. It's not like the person down the road who you're coaching against. It's someone in another continent. And I think that's really powerful.
Yeah, I agree.
I was just thinking about other bits that we've said. I've got a notepad. I was thinking about how like being on Zoom, being online has forced people to work on their self-care and self-understanding almost as well.
Oh, I'm not allowed to go out apart from for exercise at the moment. And I went walking around a park today and, you know, it's middle of the day on a Friday and there's families there with the dog. And you're like, when would this ever happen in the middle of the day? And you just think, that's another massive positive. People are starting to experience these things that they won't have ever thought about prioritising in the workday.
I walked past one of my students who was out for a run during the day, and I did want to ask why you're not in lessons, but I just ignored her.
We're forced to be still, which gives us time to reflect on where things are at and opportunities to, you know, connect with other people or read books or we and. The problem with life these days, we're all busy and we're busy with a lot of nonsense, but we're busy and we don't ever stop and slow down or step outside and look and reflect. I don't think we do that well as a society ever anymore because of the way our lives have evolved, I suppose. So I hope when everything goes back to normal that people take the lessons from that, or we do as a society to encourage and allow people to do that more, because without that time and that, you know, introspection and so forth, it's really hard for everyone to get better and to grow, I think, because you're just caught in this stream that you're taken downhill with that just takes you somewhere without a lot of control or deliberate, I guess, driving, if you like, from the person that's on that stream. So it's there's been lots of positives from that as well, as you say, to really have a think about yourself and where you're at and what you need to do and also just to be still.
You spoke about, you know, reading and how the online stuff, you're adding layers to yourself. What has been in this sort of new age of learning, what has been the big learning moment that you've had? What is there something that you've read? Is there an online webinar you've been part of? What is it that you've tapped into that's like, oh, that's a really transformative piece of information or moment that's going to influence me?
Yes, it's probably lots of scattered things, but I think things are all leading back to things connected to neuroscience and neurobiology and understanding, you know, how that all works, because I think there's simple, basic, practical ways that you can influence that, which then relates to how you perceive the world and how you feel about the world, and even to a point where you can almost hack your hormones and different bits and pieces to almost supercharge yourself into certain states of mind connected to when you've got to perform. I'm clearly no expert at it, but the more I read, I think even with some basic knowledge, there are things that you can implement into the culture and how your team operates that can have an impact on that stuff. So I think that is the next frontier for coaching, really getting a handle on what does that mean and look like at a basic level, and how can you influence that with the way you set up and run your program.
Cool. Well, thank you for your time. It's been really great to chat. We're probably up to about an hour, which is our normal cutoff.
You've hated the lack of structure, haven't you, Will? I can tell.
Yes. Oh, it's like my comfort blanket. My questions to diverge off, but it's healthy. It's growing experience for me.
We need to just microdose uncertainty just enough so that we stay awake and alert and we're thinking, you know, and we don't get stuck in this autonomous zombie space that we often do by following routines and rituals that we're comfortable with.
Yeah. Yeah, it cuts down on my coffee intake, that does.
I've had to buy decaf capsules for my Nespresso machine because otherwise I've just been getting it really wrong. That was a big learning point for me.
That's a very middle class statement. You can tell you work at a private school.
That's life, sorry. No, thanks very much for chatting to us. It's been great to just have a discussion, and we've actually gone quite deep, to be fair. That's been good.
I appreciate it, guys. It's good.
What's next for you? What's it looking like for the next few months?
Well, the biggest thing at the moment, obviously school started, so that's the job stuff. But with the Premier League coaching stuff for their local club, it's probably the main thing to get head around this month is around, you know, black stick availability. As we talked offline, you know, we've got 7 current girls in our club team, and you know, they won't be available all the time, and maybe not much, but we've got to figure out how we manage plonking potentially 7 into a team at once, and what happens to the other 7, and then what happens to the rest of the club. So that's challenging. There's some tricky logistics around making sure that we look after the team and the Black Sticks and the actual core players. So we've got to get that right as we can. It's probably my main focus over the next few weeks.
That's really difficult. Having a group of players that are going to change based on perceived level is very difficult in terms of how you keep the motivational level of the group. How do you see yourself dealing with that?
Well, last year we had 27 girls play for us. So last year we won the minor premiership, the Auckland championship or premiership, and the intercity, which is 2 regions together. So I'm not sure if it's been done before, but we cleaned the whole thing up. But we had 27 girls play at different times, and that was availability and a bit of management where we had to sit people out, because we picked a big squad because of our depth, believing that we wouldn't see the Black Sticks all year. And then like a month or 6 weeks in, it was, oh, they're going to be playing all year. So we picked a big squad that then plonked 8 people into it. And I think the squad was nearly 30 people. So we're trying to train and manage and develop kids and provide opportunities and balance that out so that we're strong enough through the year to achieve what we wanted to achieve. You know, I don't think we played with our full list past about 70% capacity the whole year, but that sort of shows you the depth. But yeah, it was very challenging to manage. And unfortunately, because we don't have any concrete answers yet, it might be just as challenging again. It's a good challenge, though. You know, you don't want to moan about having too many great players and depth, because things can go wrong, and it might be what we need at some point.
Yeah, it's. I think it's just how you. The difficult thing for me there is not making the selection decision. You know which team he's going to. If your values are based around like success on the pitch, and maybe the external pressures are around winning on the pitch, which happens, like. It's a results game. It's pretty, you can quite quickly work out what's going to be that team, roughly. The difficulty, I think, is when better players come in, how you deal with a player's self-worth, the impact that it has on the players that miss out, and on their confidence and just their motivational level. You know, you talk about self-determination theory and that impact on their value of competence and their feeling of competence. How do you negotiate that?
I think you just got to be upfront. And that was hard last year because it sort of landed in our laps. It wasn't planned. And then we had to communicate a plan and, you know, consult with the group around what that would look like. This team has an amazing culture around that sort of stuff. So it worked pretty well. But so I think that's just communication and, you know, being upfront and honest about how you think the best approach or what you think the best approach is, and trying to get, you know, them collaborating on us all saying as a group, that's what we think the approach is. So I think that stuff's generally, it's not easy, but if you do it well, it's okay with this group. I think the biggest problem is trying to balance the here and now and where we're going to be in 3, 2, 3, 5 years, because you know, we will essentially have 2 teams, as you say. We've got the core group and then a team, depending on how many Black Sticks pop back in. But then we've also got some fantastic young kids who all sort of played 3, 4, 5, 6 games last year. So that's really the biggest jigsaw or biggest piece of the jigsaw puzzle. It's looking after the future, and it's looking after the doing your playing your role for the Olympics, look after your black sticks, and also your core players who don't want to miss playing games because they're, you know, like National League level players and it's their team. So you're sharing a team between three groups, thinking about the short term outcomes whilst holding hard onto the responsibility of what we're going to look like in 5 years' time. It's not an easy puzzle.
No, what sort of pressures are on you there as a coach in that environment externally? What are you being asked to do?
The contract I have with the club doesn't have KPIs like that. You know, they talk broadly around an expectation of playing finals. But I don't really care about that sort of stuff. I talk to the girls about if we're good enough to win, then we have an obligation and a responsibility to ourselves and the club to chase that. But we don't talk about it. You know, we talk about how we're trying to play together, getting better, making sure everyone's growing inside that environment. And, you know, the belief is with the language that if we do all those things, then we will be in that space, and then we'll get to the finals and hopefully we're healthy and we've got enough good players available and we do our best to win. I think the winning at this level is an inherent objective to everybody. I don't know why you need to talk about it. Like if you're playing in the Premier League, like you should be trying to win regardless of how close you are. So really that's a distraction. The process should just be how are we trying to play? Are we getting better? How's our culture? And so forth.
Yeah. Sorry, that was just for me, that question. It wasn't really for the podcast.
Listen to him give absolutely no predictions about Tokyo and hear his reflections on his journey from fire and brimstone to Zen warrior coach. Hopefully you've enjoyed the episode and taken loads from it. He's always brilliant to chat with, and I must say, if there is opportunity to log into one of the FIH remote workshops with him, jump at it. Anyway, thanks for listening, and don't forget to listen next time for some more left field thinking. Bye bye.
Yeah, we were on the FIH Pro League thing today, and
oh yeah, I saw that. Yeah,
we were just there thinking like, you're looking at all of these different situations that people are coming up with, and people are like, oh, well, they'll be rusty because they haven't played, or they've done this because they haven't done that. And you're like, well, actually, the Belgians have played a lot. They've been training, and their honour division's been playing. They're a centralised programme. They're probably in quite good shape. But the differences, as you say, the differences that it's affected globally, and the stories that will come out, like if someone from nowhere wins, like if India win the Olympics, which is, yeah, you know, could happen, their story could be amazing.
Yeah, and even watching that game last night, like Spain looked like they just hadn't done anything in the first quarter. Like their defence was diabolical, and yeah, Belgium were up and running. But then Belgium became quite almost, Spain got a hold of their structure a little bit more tighter, and Belgium became really static and really, they just struggled to get in flow. Yeah. And it was an interesting game. If you try and think about the prep of both teams and that question you're raising there, like how that game flowed. But in the end, you know, Spain sort of got better and better, and Belgium, maybe because they started well, sort of struggled for the last three quarters, I thought. I mean, clearly it looked like they had a higher quality, but yeah, it was interesting how Spain managed to get themselves sorted and to choke the game back into a contest.
Yeah. I mean, for me, like, we were looking at certain parts of the game. One of the things I said at halftime was like, it's just pure transition when Spain get the ball. They're not going to get into a possession phase. No. But the way they were attacking really centrally.
Yeah.
That's what Belgium want you to do at the start, like, because they'll murder you on the transition going back the other way. And in towards the second half, they started to get much more around the baseline and trying to get a couple more numbers to the book, which just meant that the transition was less extreme for them. So it was easier to control it for them, even if they didn't get outcome.
Yeah, and that's something you don't hear a lot of talk about, but it's not just about the shape and the numbers of those counter attacks. It's also what does that mean if you lose it and how you can defend the transition straight back the other way.
Yeah.
And yeah, there's if you play direct like that, then there's a lot of space just to go around you and get back up the other end. So it becomes an interesting dynamic in where your numbers are when you get caught out structurally on those change of possession.